Well, all right, hello out there in Turdland. This is your pal Turd coming at you with the latest and greatest of the installment series of the TFMR podcast. Today I've got somebody new for you to get acquainted with. As most everybody knows by now, last month I flew out to Vegas and attended a wonderful conference called Freedom Fest, where I met a whole bunch of people that I was dying to meet, but I also met some people that I had not known before. And so our guest today is somebody that I didn't know prior to Freedom Fest. And I'll tell you just a quick little story. The first morning of the event, I got out of bed early and went down, got some coffee, because I was looking forward to hearing John Brown from Euro-Pacific Capital. And then Peter Schiff was going to be talking after him. And I thought, well, I got to go see these guys. Well, John Brown ends up being on this panel. And one of the guys on the panel, I sat there going, hey, this guy gets it. This is somebody. Here he's in the kind of the financial management and wealth management and asset protection business, and he actually gets it, as opposed to your regular Merrill Lynch stockbroker or your local financial planner who's just stuck living in the 90s. And so I tracked him down and said, hey, would you be willing to step into Turdville sometime if I promise, you know, we won't get your shoes too dirty? And David said yes. So I have on the line with me David McIlvaney, who is the president and CEO of the McIlvaney Financial Companies, based in Durango, California, Durango, Colorado, beautiful place. Just a little bit about them. I found this on their website. Their mission, stated mission, is to manage your portfolio with the utmost precision, applying strategies that tactfully increase your wealth while employing measures to safeguard and preserve your existing assets. I get asked a couple times a week for, you know, this is great, I love stacking and I've got some metal, but what do I do with my IRA? What do I do with my big rollover I had? Do you know any financial advisors that get it? Well, here is one. I don't have a financial stake in this. This is not like a new affiliation I'm announcing or anything. I'm simply wanted to introduce you to David because, like I said, I think the guy gets it. So David, with that as a lengthy, long drawn out introduction, hey, welcome to Turdville.
Turd, great to be with you. You know, just one comment on Merrill. They do ultimately get it. It was 1979 when our company was invited in to do special reports on the gold market. We started our business in 1972 and were actively wholesaling metals to the financial planning industry and everyone on Wall Street. We were the wholesale market back in the early 70s, 72, 73, 74, even before gold was legal. It's an interesting story in itself, but ultimately Merrill got it. Well, 1979, actually the fall of 1979, they really wanted to know about gold. Of course, as we all know, that was the six-week period where gold was going from 400 to 875, but it will dawn on them eventually this time around too.
No, I suppose that's true. Well, you're doing the Lord's work in that regard then, and still trying to open their eyes and get them to consider hard assets as part of everybody's portfolio. So, you know, it what drives me crazy is the kind of the one trick pony advisor that learned, be it 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, that you've got to have an asset allocation based off your age and you've got stocks and bonds and cash and maybe, and they're just rigid in their approach and thinking that tomorrow is going to be just like yesterday. And I got the distinct impression from hearing you speak that is not the core thesis of your investment strategy at McIlvaney.
Certainly asset preservation is important, and you can't accomplish that. You can't even approach that without a big picture view. What is happening from a macro perspective? That includes geopolitics. That includes domestic politics. That includes, of course, finance and economics. But it takes a broader picture. And I think what we have today is Wall Street full of very skilled people who operate in a very skilled way within a very small box. And unfortunately, it doesn't encompass enough of reality. And oftentimes, it's those extra realities that impinge themselves onto a portfolio negatively. So to mitigate risk, you really do have to have a fairly broad picture before you go to work.
Yes. Well, and to that end, one of the things I heard you talk about is how the paradigm has changed, and that through the last, well, really since World War II, when the U.S. became the reserve currency after Bretton Woods and was in charge of kind of rebuilding the world, we've been able to grow mainly through credit finance, if you will, through debt. And gosh, as we rounded the corner into the 21st century, but especially post-2008, it seems that that era is over. And again, most people think that that era is continuing. We're just in this kind of a rough patch. But to me, it seems like that era is over. Can you, if you agree with that, I mean, can you talk about how that impacts how someone should be managing their assets.
Yeah, well, in fits and starts, we've over the last 30 to 40 years seen a $50 trillion expansion in credit. We went from $4 trillion to $54 trillion at present. And you know, this is one of the things that has driven tremendous growth in the equity market, in the real estate market, believe it or not, in the bond market. All of them tend to move in a longer picture together at the same time. Credit is the key to any business cycle. And to the degree that credit is expanding, you have an expansionary business cycle. And this is certainly what the Keynesians have liked to do, is promote an ever-increasing, ever-expanding, always flows, never ebbs, in this expansion cycle. And now we have, in fact, contraction. And this is where, you know, clearly the last 10 years have stymied growth in the equity market. We've had the continued bull market in bonds, which we think is months to years from being over. And, you know, major changes that are taking place as a result of a slowing or stagnation of credit, even the death of credit, if you will.
And then that impacts how you should be looking to invest and not only protect, but hopefully grow your money going forward too, I would assume.
Yeah, in a period of credit contraction, you know, this is where companies are really pushed to the edge, if you will, and the best do survive. There is sort of an evolutionary process where the only the fittest survive. And we've seen this multiple times. You know, what we came out of on the other side of each of these periods of credit consolidation was a pretty amazing opportunity to be coming into equities and selectively into the bond market. You know, most recently, if you just wanted to look back at the most recent period, 1980 to 1982, this is a period where, you know, Richard Wainwater came in and started advising the Bass Brothers. And the Bass Brothers did something that the Hunt Brothers couldn't do, make a transition away from tangibles and back towards paper. And coming into another strong credit cycle, paper does very well. Mm-hmm. And it did well for 30 years. Rainwater gave him great advice. The Bass Brothers saw their fortunes grow probably 4 to 5 fold. And, you know, we're not crying any tears for the Hunt Brothers, but certainly they took a step back while others were taking a step forward. And I think this is really where an investor has to say, how am I positioned today, and do I have the flexibility of mind to recognize transitions in the marketplace and get my portfolio in line with that? Today, I think that still is, it's still helpful to look at tangibles, looking at precious metals, looking at gold and silver. I would suggest we have 24 months in the short end, 36 to 48 perhaps in the long end, before this bull market is over.
Well, and then as that leads into, I guess, maybe something we've got to be on the watch out for during that time frame that you talked about is the end of the dollar as a reserve currency. That's a subject that I talk about here at TFMR quite a bit. And when you touch upon the end of the credit cycle and credit finance growth, well, we've gotten the debt has been accumulated to such a large amount now that we can no longer really service it. And the only way left out that really seems feasible is devaluation of the currency. And so that ultimately affects the dollar's value and its functionability as a reserve currency. I talk a lot about other countries stepping to the fore to offer an alternative. I know you do too. Again, what do you see coming? And again, how are you helping your clients prepare for that, I guess, not only possibility, but maybe eventuality?
Well, we can service the debt, Turd. The question is for how long and what is the ultimate cost? What we've lost in the process of controlling interest rates and manipulating them to very low levels, most recently through Operation Twist and then the extension of Twist, you know, this is a manipulation of interest rates. This is a pressing of rates below a natural level, and what you lose is price discovery. When you begin to manipulate the bond market to unnatural levels, you lose price discovery not only in the bond market, where you don't have credit risk adequately accounted for, but you also lose price discovery in the equity markets and to some degree in all asset classes. So I think this is where we're in sort of dangerous territory, and people are very easily in a place of complacency. Because again, you look at the U.S. equity markets, you look at the U.S. bond markets, and everything appears to be just fine. But it's only because we've got a manipulated basis, and that is, you know, the 10-year and all of our rates at the shorter end of the curve. So that I think is a major issue. certainly the end of the dollar as a reserve currency gets to an issue that we're addressing right now in a current short film we're putting together on Asia and specifically China. The massive, massive gold acquisitions by the PBOC, our context in Hong Kong put it at between 30 and 40 tons per month. That's quiet buying, non-official buying. But these would be the folks that are actually handling the gold as it's moving through Hong Kong on its way to mainland China. So there is this idea that sometime on the horizon, with greater internationalization of the renminbi, they could give the dollar, the euro, the British pound, Japanese yen, a run for its money in terms of being one of the most, if not the most, important currency on the planet.
Well, and that would obviously impact hard assets, precious metals, anything that's dollar denominated. And again, I would assume that's all part of your longer term plan and what it is that you recommend for your clients.
Yeah, clearly it's we're on the horns of a dilemma at present, because you certainly have deleveraging thematics and, you know, that sense of deflation in the air. Again, when you expand credit as we have, a number of bad bets have been made, and those bets will have to be unwound to some degree. This is where the deflationists would argue heavily against gold, because they assume that it and every other asset gets sucked into the vortex in sort of a deleveraging move. That flies in the face of 600 years of both inflation and deflation, but maybe a moot point for the deflationists. What our issue is you have to deal, with an asset allocation model today, you have to deal with both the realities of deflation and inflation. And as awkward as it is, that does imply having some of your assets in cash and in a healthy percentage in gold and silver.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let me ask you one other question then about that. If we're in this period of financing debt, and that's really getting more difficult, and obviously the onus has been upon the Fed to purchase a lot of it in the last couple of years, they've been able to drive short rates even negative, or close to negative here in the U.S., negative overseas, through this demand for paper, for safety, for sovereign paper. If we get to the point where that demand starts to wane, but we can't see rates go up, you know, I fear some type of, and a lot of people have written about this, kind of a confiscatory idea where the government will almost demand, almost a conscription of capital, as I heard you call it, some type of capital control, almost demand the individual purchase government debt to finance things. Again, I remember hearing you talk about that. Could you? I guess kind of talk about some of your concerns there, how that would impact the investor, and then, and lastly, that kind of feeds into some of the concerns that people have about confiscation of gold again, a la what happened back in the Great Depression.
When you look at the size of the capital pools in question, I think you can sort of look at the opportunity for government and determine where the greatest risks are in terms of those capital pools. The easiest capital pool for them to utilize in terms of conscription of capital would be the pension assets, which run well above almost $15 trillion. Mm-hmm. And again, this is an asset base that no one is in control of. No one knows what their state, local, teacher's pension or what have you is invested in. So, you know, if a report were to come out and say, hey, we're losing money because of private managers who are taking outsized risks, and we just need to define what is prudent asset management. What is the new prudent rule? If we can define the new prudent man rule for pensions, it may include a 15 to 20% allocation mandatory to treasuries. And that to me is a hypothetical case of a conscription of capital. Sort of the next available pocket of capital would be your 401ks and IRAs. But, Turd, you and I both know, if these assets we consider to be ours, individual retirement accounts, it's a little awkward telling mm-hmm. someone what they should be doing with their money. And, you know, so to a large group of people where there's fiduciary responsibility, certainly that prudent man idea can be put in place. But when you start messing with people's personal assets, you're going to see some pushback. You're definitely going to see some pushback from the general public. There's political ramifications attached with that kind of a move that don't exist with pension assets. And so I would say pension assets are likely to be the first in the line of conscripted assets. Now, when it comes to gold, the we've been in this business for four decades, so certainly the conversation and the discussion has been there. We came into the business and were selling bullion for 4 years before it was legal to own gold, gold bullion. Bullion had been confiscated in 1933, and you could own religious relics, you could own rare coins, and we were able to have 1 2-ounce 24-karat gold medallions minted with religious themes on them. And we sold them as bullion.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But I mean, that gave us a 3 to 4 year advantage over anyone else in the market. Everyone else was selling rare coins who happened to be in the gold market at that time. But, you know, we knew that environment because here we are living with the legacy in 72, 73, 74, into early 75 of what it meant to have gold confiscated. But I think it's important to look back at monetary history and see that what was accomplished in 33 was not a gold grab, but really the Fed wrapping their arms around the money supply. They effectuated a devaluation of the currency, and that was to them more important than having possession of physical gold. That's not what they were ever after. In fact, if you go back to the ounces that were brought in after that confiscation order in 1933, the Trading with the Enemy Act, about 10% was voluntarily handed in. 90% of the gold outstanding, and so I guess we could say a high percentage of Americans, basically said, go pound sand. Yeah. It's ours, and if you're interested in it, I think we might should be as well. This devaluation that occurred was already anticipated in the French market. If you were in Paris, France in 1931, 32, $20 gold pieces, 1 ounce gold coins, were already selling at a 40 to 50% premium in anticipation of the 65% devaluation which occurred in 33. So, you know, that's what occurred, devaluation and the Fed getting their arms around the money supply. They didn't actually go door to door. They weren't interested in collecting the rest of the 90% of the gold. They got what they wanted. So tell me, Turd, what would they be accomplishing by going after gold today when far less of the general public even knows what an ounce of gold looks like? They've never owned any. They haven't allocated either their IRAs or non-IRA assets, non-qualified, they don't own an ounce, and no one in their family for three generations has owned an ounce.
Excellent point.
So our concerns, I guess you could say, we look at it and we say, while it is a low probability event, it still is a possibility. It still is a possibility. For us, that's translated into just having other options. You can own the kinds of products that were not confiscated back in that time period, but of course you're going to pay very high premiums for it. Or you can own bullion, just own it in a different geographic jurisdiction. You can own it in Switzerland, you can own it in Toronto, you can own it in Singapore and Hong Kong. We've set up programs for our clients to be able to do this. You know, again, phone call away to purchase, to liquidate. If you want to go to Toronto, you can pick up your product. Take a six-month vacation in Toronto if you Washington, D.C. is getting a little dicey. Keep your options open. I frankly, Turd, am more concerned about destabilization socially and politically than I am government confiscating my gold, in which case I want a pre-funded vacation fund. That's why I would have a part of my assets in physical metals outside of the United States.
Excellent set of points. And I do agree with you. I find that unlikely. I didn't realize that the number was that low, that they really only accumulated 10% of it anyway. So in this day and age, it'd be tough to even get that far. David, I mentioned this series. I'm linking here in this podcast the YouTube link to the first in this series called The Fuse is Lit. You said you're working on the second one. Tell, if you would, everyone, is there a way for people to subscribe? Should they just keep an eye on your YouTube channel? If they call the 800 number, can they get these discs mailed to them as they come out? Because I think the second one, I'm sure, will be fantastic.
All of the above. Okay. If you want to receive it automatically and digitally, if we have your email, we can get it out to you straight away. If you want a physical copy, obviously that takes more time to get it produced, but we have physical copies of European Perils, The Fuse is Lit. That's already available, so you can get in touch with us through McIlvaney.com if you want a physical copy. What we do to stay in touch with people, we do a weekly podcast that goes out to tens of thousands of people across the country, mostly our clients who we just want to keep in touch with, let them know what our thoughts are in terms of market gyrations. Sometimes we'll have central bankers on, politicians, academics. We have a variety of guests, or it's just in-house analysis. In an attempt to sort of bolster that, once a year we've come up with our sort of State of the Union, which we've put in film format. Now, last year it was, you know, roughly an hour long. The year before that it was an hour long. And frankly, there's too much happening too quickly to consolidate an hour's worth of data and draw from the first 6 months of the year and look forward to the last 6 months and try to anticipate. So we've tried to make it more real time. We've done 3 20-minute films. As you mentioned, the first one was on Europe and our concerns with the European Union. The second one is dealing with Asia, specifically China. We've called it Asian Ascendance. Question mark. We don't know that there's as much clarity as to where, you know, how China will succeed, or if they will succeed in the reforms that are necessary, primarily of a political nature, for them to take sort of the next step forward in the developed world. And the last one will be a post-election synthesis. I think everyone's going to be very interested to know, what are the ramifications of a Romney win? What are the ramifications of an Obama win? And what do the next 4 years look like? And this is really crunch time for us, because as the limelight begins to move from Europe to the United States in terms of our own balance sheet issues, this is, again, whoever is in leadership is going to have a different set of responses, either exacerbating the problems or, I think, frankly, exacerbating the problems. At this point, I'm not sure that there's not too much already baked into the cake, where, frankly, I'm not sure it matters whoever wins, it doesn't matter in terms of its impact to the markets.
The joke here at TFMR is that the virtual certainty of the election is that Obama will win. All right, so we can go to McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com to register to be notified when the next is out, right? The next in the series?
Right, exactly. Okay.
And you can sign up for these podcasts as well.
Exactly. It's all free. But, you know, so Wednesday we've got our weekly commentary. Friday our written comments on the wealth management website. And then, you know, again, every quarter, just nearly every quarter, three times this year, we've got the DVDs which are being produced. So if you want a hard copy, great, ask for it. We'll send it to you. If you want to look at it online, you can look at it online at YouTube, sign in, register on our YouTube page, whatever. You can watch it without registering. Enjoy. We're just trying to unpack the world, help people make perspicacious decisions in what is you know, challenging time.
It certainly is. Thank you very much, David. And I would, again, encourage everyone to check it out. Check out this latest video. Check out McIlvaney.com. And if it's something that you have an interest in talking to them further, I'm sure that the information is provided there too, an 800 number and that kind of stuff. And you can call up and somebody there will be able to help you out and answer additional questions anybody might have. Right, David?
Perfect. We'd be happy to help you.
David, thank you. I hope we can keep in touch, and maybe you can wander back into Turdville from time to time. And until we can speak again, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time, and thanks for all you're doing.
Look forward to the next time.